Guess we'll start with some meditation here in a minute. Let's see. I don't know. I'm trying to think if there's anything else to say right now. All I know is I need some meditation. I had kind of a crazy day. So let's see. I'll give a talk after the meditation, and then we hopefully will have some time for some discussion back and forth, because I'd love to hear from you all. I almost wish we could do that now to see how everybody's doing, and then that would give me a better idea of what to talk about. But anyway, I'm going to talk about some aspects of right thought later. And in the meantime, why don't we get ourselves a little bit centered and calmed, and I'll give some guided instructions as we go along, and then there will be some periods of silence, which I think is what Kevin does too. And yeah, I recognize some of you and not everyone, but I'm happy to be with you tonight, and we can, be in our recovery together. So let's go ahead and find a comfortable posture for the meditation, whatever is calling to you at this moment. It's usually good to have your back fairly straight and upright. If you're lying down, obviously that would be different. The key with lying down is obviously to try to stay awake, because if we lie down and close our eyes, there's like a cue to the body and mind, go to sleep. So for the next 25, 30 minutes, we'll meditate together. So start by noticing there is this body sitting here. You might take a deep breath or two here at the beginning, just as a way to connect with the breath and to arrive more fully here in this present moment. You could think of it as establishing mindfulness. One of the instructions is establish mindfulness to the fore. Nobody seems to know what to the fore means, but I kind of like the phrase. Just as best we can, connecting with the sense of the body sitting here, aware of what's happening, aware of the breath, aware of sounds arising and passing away. You might do a gentle scan through the body, maybe starting at the top of the head and moving down, just noticing what you can relax or soften around. Relaxing the muscles in the face, softening around the eyes, dropping the shoulders a little if needed, relaxing the any tension we're noticing in our back, upper arms, shoulders, neck. So part of the art of meditation is just learning how to relax. You might soften the belly, not holding tension there. Relax the rest of the arms. Relax the legs. Big part of meditation is just practicing letting go. For many of us, we've been in doing mode all day. This is a chance to practice, turn our systems to being mode. It's like airplane mode for humans. no messages we need to receive right now, unless they're coming from inner, you know, bodily messages, intuition. Trying to leave our worries and plans at the door so that we can do some deeper listening. And I really use the breath a lot. Breathing in. I know I'm breathing in. Breathing out. I know I'm breathing out. It's very simple, straightforward. Letting go of distractions as best we can. Sometimes a short gratitude practice here could be good. Just taking a moment to think about a couple things we could be grateful for. Grateful to be clean and sober today, for example. I'm grateful to have this time to work on my own well-being. Grateful to Spirit Rock for hosting this event and providing staff support. You might notice what the gratitude practice does for your mind, if anything. And just reconnecting with the body, if we lost that connection, feeling the contact with the chair or cushion or whatever we have contact with, floor, feel the hands. Coming back to the breath. Each breath is unique, impermanent. We might remember our motivation for the practice, whatever it may be. May my practice help me be kinder to those closest to me. Including myself. And if the mind wanders, which is very normal, we don't make a problem of it. We don't get down on ourselves about it. We just notice it, see if we can let go, come back to the next in-breath. Always with a sense of kindness for ourselves. When we notice we've been lost in thought, that's a moment of mindfulness, so we can feel good about that. See if you can rest in the knowing of the thoughts rather than being lost in the content of the thoughts. Thoughts being known. We try to cultivate an open, receptive, curious attitude in meditation. No real agenda here. Just relax. Breathe, feel the body sitting here, feel the breath, try to let go of distraction. You might check in, just notice if you're lost in a compelling story or plan. That's pretty normal. You might could even label the thought planning, remembering, if it's helpful. Then let it go. See if you can come back. Reconnect with the breath or the body. Re-establishing mindfulness. So keeping up our persistent effort in practice. We just try to stay with it. If you get sleepy, you might open your eyes, just gaze at the floor in front of you, or the wall. One instruction I heard recently was to try not centering our thoughts as we meditate. Another way of saying that might be, well, what if our thoughts weren't the most important thing in this moment? And just staying with the in-breaths and out-breaths. Staying connected to the body. And as we practice, see if you can connect with the, what one teacher calls the subtle joy of being in the present moment. In those moments when we can let go of all the distractions, worries, plans, memories, judgments. Just being, keeping it very simple. Feeling the breath, being fully present. Sometimes a very subtle joy can arise naturally just from that presence, presence of mind. Okay, so that concludes the meditation part. And I believe now we have a break for about 10 minutes. And just to say, if you had any questions about the meditation, anything I said, I'm happy to answer them after the talk. So we'll try to have some time for any kind of questions and responses after I give the talk later. But I'd be curious if you did have any questions about any of that. So hopefully you had a good, useful meditation period. And we'll take this short break, I believe, for 10 minutes. And we'll see you back here at just about 8 o'clock Pacific time. All right, so in thinking about what to talk about tonight, I came across a chapter in a book by Joseph Goldstein called this book, Mindfulness, A Practical Guide to Awakening. And he has a chapter on right thought, or a couple chapters on right thought, like a section. And one of them has always jumped out at me in particular, where he talks about renunciation, which he acknowledges is a word we don't tend to be drawn to a lot of the time. But he likes to kind of retranslate the word renunciation as non-addiction, practicing non-addiction. And that has always kind of stood out to me as an interesting thing. And you could almost say being in recovery, what we're practicing is non-addiction. We were really good for however long we were caught in our addiction of choice or addictions of choice. We were really good at practicing addiction, right? So now we're in recovery, we're practicing non-addiction. Just always thought that was an interesting way to look at it. And or you could just say practicing renunciation. For me, I'm a recovering alcoholic addict. So today I don't drink and I don't use drugs. And but of course it's not just that simple. There's a lot more... there's a lot to say here. I was also thinking that I initially got into recovery in 1987 when I was only 21. But I kind of feel like I entered recovery 2.0 or something. I know some guy has already been using that, a yoga teacher. But anyway, it was like the second level of my recovery happened like about 15 years in or so, when I went on my first retreat at Spirit Rock and I'd had an interest in Buddhism for quite a while, and I'd been to various sitting groups and things, and I was getting a lot out of that. But then, I had a hard time when I'd go home and try to practice on my own. It felt kind of all over the place. And, I had a hard time establishing a real daily practice, even though it sounded like probably a good idea. I was better going to recovery meetings regularly, I guess because of the social aspect, but I didn't really get a real daily meditation practice going until I went on that first retreat and then another one soon after, because that's when you're just kind of meditating all day for 5 days, 10 days, whatever it is. And then when you go home, meditating for, say, 30 or 40 minutes each day suddenly doesn't seem like that big of a deal. And also, hopefully on the retreat, we got a real taste of kind of the peace that you can get from the practice. And certainly I did on my first two retreats. The first retreat was, of course, challenging, but I learned a lot. And then the second retreat, which was only like a month later, I was between jobs at the time, so I had a lot of free time. I was kind of ready for that second retreat. Everything I'd done wrong preparing for the first retreat, which was like have an argument with my housemate right before I went on the retreat. And then every time I went to meditate on that first retreat, that's what came into my mind, was like this ongoing conflict. And it was pretty small stuff, but nonetheless, I noticed it really kept coming up because I didn't resolve it before I left, you know. So the next time I went on a retreat, I made sure to kind of resolve conflicts if I had any. Just tried to really make sure everything was taken care of to the point where while I was on retreat, I didn't need to be worrying about anything else. And that really did help my practice. And that's kind of like there's bodily seclusion of, say, going on a retreat. And then there's mental seclusion, which is more around, you know, that ethical behavior and sort of taking care of our side of the street. When the Buddha talked about it, he included right livelihood, that our job doesn't sort of break the precepts, that kind of thing. If you're not familiar with the precepts, there are five precepts for lay people, non-monastics, which start with not killing living beings, not taking that which isn't freely offered, not stealing, not lying, like avoiding false or deceptive speech, not acting out with our sexuality in some way that would harm anybody else, including ourselves. And then also the last one is not taking intoxicants that cloud the mind, which there have been, you know, Buddhist recovery groups kind of called the fifth precept or something, because the fifth precept is kind of our right in our wheelhouse, shall we say. And the interesting thing about the fifth precept that's, you know, instructive is if you just break that one precept, thinking everything's going to be fine, often once you're intoxicated, say, then you start breaking the others, you know. Suddenly it becomes a lot easier to you know, to lie to somebody, take something that wasn't freely offered. If you need a beer and you're out and they have one, you know, you can see how, as we say, it's a slippery slope. So there's bodily seclusion and then mental seclusion. I've just been really, I wrote an essay recently about seclusion for some reason. So that's one reason I'm mentioning it. It's an interesting topic given the whole COVID thing, and some of us are probably tired of seclusion, and I totally get that. But this is just, for me, what I noticed was, in the mornings, my partner, woman, she would take our daughter to school, and I would be up because I was sort of like making breakfast for my daughter and stuff, and then so suddenly everybody would leave the house, and I'd realize, oh, I'm alone in the house. This feels kind of precious all of a sudden. And so often I would meditate then while everybody was out. And I just started to notice how peaceful that was. Not that I can't meditate when people are in the house, but it just felt a little extra supportive when nobody else was there. And I could sort of really just be like, okay, nobody's going to bother me. And I would, you know, turn off my cell phone or whatever. And so that's a tiny version of seclusion, but hey, we can really appreciate that too. So it might even mean just, you know, the Buddha really valued things like seclusion and renunciation. And one thing I'm noticing about Buddhist teachings is it's sort of a value system that it values these certain things that maybe weren't always my top priorities, especially when I was using or in early recovery, because I thought the pursuit of happiness was about pleasure. And certainly pleasure is lovely, but is it really happiness? And that's one of the things the Buddha talked about a lot, that it's so impermanent, so fleeting, and that really what we end up getting caught up in is not so much enjoying the pleasant experience as in craving these pleasant experiences, and when they go away, craving for more of them and being remorseful that it didn't last longer, whatever it is. So the Buddha just asked us to start looking at how this is operating and to maybe look at what we've been valuing and what we've been practicing and see if that's really bringing us the happiness we thought it was. There was an article in the AA Grapevine one time. I just saved the one line of it. Somebody wrote, "I spent 28 years confusing stimulation for happiness." I spent 28 years confusing stimulation for happiness. And I think that's kind of what the Buddha's saying, too. That often our idea of pleasure is just kind of stimulation. We don't want to be bored. We want to just feel like something's exciting is happening. But that is that really happiness? So the Buddha was pointing us towards another idea that we can have of happiness. And so part of this is looking at the habits in our lives. What are my habits, and are they really serving me? Are these healthy habits or habits that I might want to look at and possibly change? And I think that the mindfulness practice, when we really start cultivating a regular practice, can help us a lot with changing sort of habits that aren't working for us and cultivating more helpful habits, skillful habits, habits that do lead to some peace of mind and, deeper contentment. There's a sutta that has a line. I think it's even on my, I have a website, and it's the key line on my website. Whatever we frequently think and ponder upon, that will become the inclination of the mind. Whatever we frequently think and ponder upon, that will become the inclination of the mind. So, we're always practicing something because, the mind, where the mind goes, kind of where we go in a way. So the Buddha kind of, the full quote is more, if one frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, one has abandoned the thought of renunciation. This is the Buddha talking. Abandon the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire, and then their mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. Similar for ill will or cruelty. If we, if we're thinking about ill will or cruelty, then we've abandoned non-cruelty or, loving kindness, non-ill will. So it's kind of an either or. I just find these to be helpful reminders. I don't think this is probably anything you haven't heard before, but sometimes it's helpful to hear it and kind of really think about, where am I at with this stuff right now? Like, how did I do today? And we don't beat ourselves up if we didn't do too well today, but we maybe set an intention that we would like to do better in the future and try to think about how could I go about accomplishing that. Let's see. So this is kind of getting into right thought or right intention, which is the second step on the Noble Eightfold Path. The first step is around right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Those are the eight steps of the Noble Eightfold Path. And I was just going to talk a bit about right intention or right thought, and that's kind of what we got into already. Some people, they talk about cruelty and ill will. The Joseph Goldstein in the book had an interesting line about that. He said that cruelty, as we pay attention to these two kinds of thought between you know, wholesome and unwholesome. We see the strength and seductive powers of the unwholesome patterns. So there's a lot of seductive powers in, even in ill will. That's because it feels kind of powerful when we get angry at somebody and we feel kind of righteous and I'm right and they're wrong kind of thing. And we get, there's something kind of seductive about that. And so as a result, in Buddhism, it's, according to Joseph Goldstein, it's ill will and aversion are said to be more dangerous than greed and desire, but also easier to uproot, which I just think is interesting. And he said, explains why there's a tendency, whereas ill will is more a kind of, ill will is more kind of a, well, basically the reason is because with ill will, it can really lead to harm. And so it's kind of dangerous in that way that we really might act, if we're acting out of ill will or anger or cruelty, then obviously we could really hurt somebody. And also, even when we're in that, it's pretty unpleasant. Usually, right? I mean, yes, there might be a certain seductive strength to it, but in general, when we're kind of really in a state of anger, it's pretty unpleasant. I got stressed today. There was some things going on, and I was trying to focus on one thing, and I kept getting interrupted by another thing that I didn't really want to have to deal with, but that was also urgent, and I was like, it just got very stressful, and I was feeling kind of, I guess you could say some ill will about it. And I did notice it felt kind of awful. It was like, this is not a good feeling. I was not I wouldn't say I had a great day today because I felt a little too much of that. And I, I didn't act out too terribly or anything, but I definitely felt all the feelings of it. And it wasn't fun. So, and I kind of had, there was some sort of restraint of pen and tongue going on. nowadays it's too easy to, it's not pen, it's tapping the little texts. You can tap a text message so fast. Honestly, we need more mindfulness today than we ever needed before in order to try to restrain ourselves here. But anyway, and the reason it's, and that's the reason that ill will is easier to let, to uproot, as they say, is that we can very clearly see that it's painful when we're in it. It's pretty, and so then the opposite, when we're caught in the sense desire, the problem with that is it doesn't seem like it's harming anybody. And it's very pleasurable, so we can't quite understand why we should have to give that up. You know, why is there a better value than this? I'm really enjoying my whatever it is, chocolate, whatever. Could be many things. but I think you get the idea. I just thought that was interesting. There's a famous line in the Dhammapada that's... you may have heard, if by giving up a lesser happiness, a greater happiness could be found, a wise person would renounce the lesser for the sake of the greater. And I'll have to say, that sounds really good, and I also know it's not easy. Because when we're having a lesser happiness, we're still having a happiness, right? I'm reflecting back my early sobriety. There's a story I tell a lot. There was like a key night in my early sobriety where I was living in a college town and where I went to rehab and didn't know a whole lot of people there, but I knew a few people at the college because it was a pretty big school and I was still only 22 when this happened. And So one night, I got basically a buddy of mine, one of my old drinking buddies or using buddies, much more than just a drinking buddy, really. a guy I grew up with, he was at the college, and he told me there was going to be this huge party next door to my apartment building. So he went out of his way to, like, tell me about it. And I lived alone in this tiny apartment, in this apartment building, and he told me to come by the party. You know, he's like, I'll be there for sure, and, you know, you're welcome to come. So, you know, it was nice to see him or whatever during the day. And so that night, I was like, I can't go to that party. But then I went to a meeting, 12-step meeting, and then I hung out with people afterwards. And then, but then everybody had to go home, and then I eventually went home, and it's like 11 o'clock at night. Well, the party is just starting to get raging because it's like one of these monster college parties. And, you know, it's very loud, and there's just people laughing and music and everything. And I go home, and I can hear it, you know, from my apartment. And my sort of addict mind is saying, well, hey, I'm invited to that party. I can go over to that party. My buddy's going to be there. And you know, I got a little lonely because it's like everybody else had to go home and I was living alone. And so the voice in my head, I was like, well, it'd be fun to go to a party. I haven't been to a good party in a while. But fortunately, I'd been to enough, you know, been in recovery long enough to know right now is when you call somebody, pick up the phone. So I picked up the phone and called a few people, and I don't know how long it took, but finally I got a guy that I had only met at like a sober poker game, you know, like the week before, but I thought he was kind of had a funny sense of humor. And so I told him what was going on, and he said, do you know how to play backgammon? And I said, no. the game never interested me. He said, well, come over and I'll teach you. And I mean, I have to say, that party right before I got a hold of this guy, I was really close. And I really felt like if I went to that party, it was going to be very hard not to use, because the buddy that I knew there was just really a hardcore, one of the guys that would always talk me into using, even when I didn't want to, before recovery. So anyway, I went over and learned how to play backgammon with this new sober friend, and I had a good time, and I met his roommate. You know, like I made new friends that night in a wholesome way. And I, you know, I'm still close friends with that guy to this day, and it's been 35 years almost. And that's just amazing to me. We both stayed sober this whole time. And I really think that was a pivotal moment for me that night, because my old value system was a party's a party. That's always the funnest thing you could possibly do. But the truth is, going and playing backgammon and making a new recovery buddy turned out to be one of the best decisions I ever made, you know. But it went against a lot of my old conditioning. So I hope this is useful to hear about, but that, this is kind of the stuff we're talking about. So Joseph Goldstein says, we often have difficulty, as I mentioned, with that word renunciation, because it sounds like repression or deprivation, or it might just sound too austere, or it's like we're entering a monastery because we're practicing renunciation. So he says, I just wanted to give you the quote. He says, a more accurate and liberating understanding of renunciation would be as the experience of non-addiction. We all know the suffering bound up with addictions, whatever they may be. So this is, you know, we're moving in the opposite direction of that, towards non-addiction. At least that's one way to look at it. He also says we become addicted not only to the gratification of our wants, but also to the mental habit of wanting itself. I've come to think of this as being an extremely important point, at least for me. I remember, you know, when I was still caught in my addictions, like I smoked a lot of weed, and I can remember But I had all these various, like, paraphernalia. And also, I lived in a small town that didn't always have a lot of weed. So there were dry periods. So if you were really into it, you didn't necessarily always have any. And so I would, but I just remember sitting around in my bedroom alone, you know, wanting weed, you know, wanting that experience, not having any weed, but I would keep my seeds. I would get the seeds out of the weed and put them in a little test tube, plastic test tube with a top on it. And I would just look at the seeds sometimes, you know, and like rattle them around and think about them or something. I mean, I just, you know, it was just like caught in that wanting mind of, so, you know, I just think this is really true. And there are, modern neuroscience has borne out that this is very much the case, that our brains are wired for wanting, wired for craving. And that some scientists have said, you know, desire is what the brain does best. So practicing non-addiction or renunciation would be, you know, letting go of this kind of wanting, like not valuing it anymore, seeing like there's nothing really there's no real gratification in just the wanting. So just starting to see how that's operating has been very important to me. And Joseph points out how it's happening all the time. Like he talks about catalog consciousness. So you'll go out and get the mail and there'll be a new catalog. And if it's in an all interesting, you know, sometimes my wife gets things I'm not as interested in, but you know, if it's something I'm interested in at all, then, you know, you start flipping it, flipping the pages, and we're just hoping that there will be something for us to want in the catalog. You know, like it's kind of this weird practice that we do of like, oh great, a catalog to give me a chance to want something. Whether we can afford it or not is even a whole nother, doesn't even matter. A lot of the time it's just that. And, you know, I mean, I think Amazon, companies like that, if that's how they get us, I myself have a bad habit of going. I used to love where the Amazon would have, you know, Walt's recommendations or whatever they called it. And it'd be like, oh, what do they think I might want? You know, and then just see the list. Are they right about any of this stuff? And, you know, we're just really good at that. And I don't think it's going to go away per se, but I think we can stop valuing it in a way. We can start practicing something to counterbalance it, which is this mindfulness practice that the Buddha offered and that we, you know, practice at places like Spirit Rock and here on Zoom even. And I mentioned during the meditation the subtle joy of being in the present moment. And that's become kind of my new go-to carrot, I guess, is that, you know, starting to value the subtle joy of being in the present moment, which is actually really amazing when I can remember to do it, remember to practice it. And, you know, for example, I have a young daughter, and there's such a big difference between when I'm really just being fully present with her and non-distracted and just interacting with her, or if I'm secretly like wanting, like looking at my phone because I'm expecting an important text or email from somebody or something. And so I got kind of one eye on her and one eye on my phone, and she really notices it too and does not like it, you know. That is the good thing about kids a lot of the time, is it's an instant feedback loop of like, daddy, she will like literally jump on me sometimes if I seem distracted. So, but you get the idea that it's just really to start noticing the difference between when our attention is kind of divided and when we're just really fully here with another person or just with whatever we're doing. This kind of idea of non-distraction has become another value that I've acquired, you know, from this practice. That I'm not saying I'm practicing it perfectly, but just the idea that it's actually really nice to practice non-distraction, and that there's a real happiness that comes from that. So Joseph also says, you know, what's beguiling about our addictions is that in the moment of gratification, they do give us pleasure. So that, you know, and we talked about the lesser happiness thing. It's not that we don't get any pleasure or gratification from these things. Otherwise, why would we do them at all? But as the Buddha had this teaching about seeing the gratification, the danger, and the escape of things, of these sense pleasures. And so I like it, that list, because he's acknowledging there is some gratification. There is a reason that we're doing this stuff, that there is some pleasure in it. But what we forget is that there's also the danger, the drawback to it. And the danger, but we don't really tend to care about that. We just want more and more of the pleasure, and we kind of overlook the danger. Certainly if we're in recovery, we've all dealt with this, waking up after a, you know, rough night and swearing, I'm not going to do that again. And, you know, a lot of times I would wake up in really crazy situations where I really should have rationally not done that again. And then the next night, I'm completely right back there doing the same thing again. So, I just remember waking up out of a blackout in somebody's car one time, and I had been at a party, and I needed somewhere to... Everybody just kind of crashed at the party, and there was no room for me, I felt like at the time. So I started walking around this neighborhood looking for where I could sleep, and I just found the guy's car door wasn't locked, so I slipped in the back seat, it looked like a comfortable car, and passed out. And then the next morning, he came out to go to work, and I'm sleeping in the back of his car. So he like starts to open his... That's about when I woke up, too. It's like, there's somebody opening the car door. And I was like, oh, what's going on? And then he ran back in his house and called the police. This is before cell phones, I guess. It's a long time ago. But and then his wife, I get out of the car, and I'm like slinking away, and his wife's yelling, do you have a problem or something? And yes, I do have a problem. But fortunately, that one did not lead to a interaction with the police, but easily could have. So just to say, but that did not slow me down a bit. That was just a minor event. So so we were talking about the gratification, the danger, and the escape. You know, the disadvantage, just wanted to finish that. And then the escape is kind of what we've been really talking about, how we can, you know, part of it is when we see this stuff clearly, then what can kick in is what's called disenchantment and dispassion. We suddenly realize this isn't as great as I thought it was, and I don't know if this is really a good... thing for me to keep doing to myself. It's still happening all the time in my life in different ways, because yes, I am clean and sober from the main drugs and alcohol that I once did, but I'm still dealing with things like sugar, caffeine, you know, all kinds of other things that we have to also work with, you know, exercise or the lack of exercise. There's so many considerations that we have to keep working with. So it doesn't really go away. It just, we keep looking at the stuff. But when I'm really, you know, practicing and sort of staying spiritually fit, we might say, then a lot of this stuff becomes very easy to work with, because I know what my choices are. I'm going for the wholesome, healthy choice these days, you know, as best I can. And but it's that can be really hard around certain things like sugar, you know, for example. And we each kind of have to find our way with it. So I'm saying a lot here, and I do want to give time to hear from you and maybe answer some questions, but I'll offer a couple more things from this chapter. The chapter from Joseph Goldstein, because he talks about, he says we can practice developing a wise restraint where we settle back and allow the desires to arise and pass away without feeling the need or compulsion to act on them. This is another, you know, way of renunciation or non-addiction, and we're using mindfulness here to help us have this wise restraint so that you know that we will have the desire, but we try not to act on it, and we just let it. We know it's impermanent, and that it will arise and then pass away eventually. And of course, there's a real push to it when it's has arisen, so we have to be a bit willing to withstand that a little bit. I've been dealing with this weird problem where I have a like a recurring itch on my leg that won't go away. It keeps coming back. It might be probably have I don't know what, but anyway, all I really have to do is not scratch it, and everything's fine. But it's very hard not to scratch an itch. So this has been a very interesting practice for me. I tried various creams and different things and haven't really found exactly the right thing yet. But and it's nothing terrible, but it would be kind of nice for it to totally clear up and go away, you know. And the itch part is really kind of rough. And well, some days I'm doing great with it, and some days I completely lose it and just scratch away. But you know, this is a perfect example because the scratching is temporary relief from the itching, but really it only makes it much worse. So it's kind of an interesting metaphor for what we're talking about here. Currently, I'm happy to report I'm in a really good place with it, where it's getting a lot better, and maybe it'll go away soon. So, but it's been there for a while, and it's been kind of an up and down situation. So yeah, there's just always something that we can that we're probably going to have to be working with. I find that it'd be nice just being in a body. The Buddha talked about dukkha, that there's just kind of a certain type of suffering inherent with this body that, and especially as we get older, it seems like we work with it more and more in a way. So I honestly, the older I get, the more grateful I am to have this kind of practice to work with this kind of stuff, bodily issues, and not to take it so personally that it's coming out of various causes and conditions going on in my body, some of which are out of my control, and so I have to just kind of make peace with them. Let's see. So Joseph talks about how we can have, we can also practice what he calls the wisdom of no, N-O, as opposed to K-N-O-W. So the wisdom of no, which is when we recognize that some things that might come up, some ideas that might come up in our mind or whatever, that they aren't skillful, they're not helpful, and they don't lead to happiness. So we notice, we kind of, in this case, we practice saying, no thanks, I'll pass. It's like that party that I didn't go to, you know, that was a key practice of no for me that was, you know, felt like it really was a crossroads in my early recovery where it could have easily gone the other way. And it's funny because I went, when I was in, I went to like a 28-day treatment center, and they had assertiveness class. Which was interesting, and I took it twice because I really liked the teacher, but it was interesting because yeah, I wasn't good at saying no. That was something I hadn't really been that good at when I was in my addiction mode. It was I didn't really have a good no switch, you know? The wisdom of no is not part of my vocabulary in a weird way. So we actually would practice saying no to people in the assertiveness class. And this is, you know, sadly for me, it was useful. You know, I actually needed to practice. So, yeah, I mean, I would like to think I've come a long way from that. But in some ways, I have to be grateful that I had that class. So anyway, the point being simply that this idea, the wisdom of no, is something that we can begin to consciously practice. And we practice it not as a version of avoidance or repression, but using discriminating wisdom. And I mean, for me, it's like if somebody offers me a cookie, right, for my body right now, no is the right answer, even though I love cookies, you know. So I love the taste of cookies, but the effect of cookies, not so much. It kind of, I was diagnosed pre-diabetic a little while back, and so I'm just dealing with that. And so cookies are not really something that I can really can have one every now and then, but I have to be very careful. So I'm practicing no for stuff like that. Ice cream. I ate ice cream my first year of sobriety. I had one of those, I don't know, is it a half pint of Ben and Jerry's ice cream? I don't think it's a pint. I had one of those every night for a year. I mean, I really think I think that's pretty true. I mean, I'm sure I must have missed occasional nights, but pretty much I would have one of those at least. And then at some point it just suddenly dawned on me, like, this can't be healthy eating one of these every single night. And so I started to kind of not have so many, but anyway, it seems to be a part of my addiction as well, is around sugar. Okay, so just seeing if there's anything else that I wanted to mention. So we've talked a lot about renunciation, and that's kind of how we work with the sense desires, sense pleasure. It's the right thought, right intention around sense pleasure. And it's not to say that we can't ever enjoy stuff. Really don't want to give that impression, but that we do it, you know, mindfully, and and aware of any drawbacks that this, whatever I'm doing, might have, so that I'm not just caught in, like, perpetually chasing it for pleasure, 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 and not thinking about any drawbacks. And just really being a little more wise with these things. And so that's how we work with that aspect. And then, because I talked about ill will as well and cruelty, and the way you counterbalance that is by cultivating loving kindness and goodwill. There's various practices for that. Kevin's probably talked about them over, if you heard him much. He has a new book. He has his previous book, Living Kindness, is now being republished by Shambhala, and so it's coming out, I think, in December, but it's nice that they're going to give it kind of a mass publication, and it's a great book. So you could read that book to kind of cultivate if ill will or aversion, anger are an issue for you, that cultivating loving kindness and that intention of loving kindness can be a very powerful counterbalance to that. Kind of running out of time to talk about it too much. But I'm always amazed, because I've had some, I don't know if the word is aversion, but I've had some resistance to doing that practice. And then every time I do it, I'm amazed at how powerful it can be. I've done a fair amount of work in prisons, taking Buddhist practices into prison. especially this one prison in Vacaville, California. And some of my other volunteers said we should do meta practice, you know, with the group that we had. We had about like maybe 20 guys at the time. And I was a little bit like, it's, you know, I don't know if they're ready for that kind of soft practice or something. But everybody else said, no, we really need to do it. So I just remember, for some reason, it was my turn to lead it, and I led the meta. And it was like the whole, this prison chapel turned into a whole different place. Like, I don't know if I could ever explain it, but it felt like the whole room melted into love. Like, these guys were really practicing very sincerely. And even because we were in a divided room, so there were other religious services happening on the other side of a divider in this prison chapel, right? Even the guys in the other side of the chapel came over and started being warmer and interacting with me more than usual after we did metta practice that day. So in the metta practice is usually you repeat phrases, may you be happy and peaceful, may you be healthy and strong. And you don't even have to mean it. You just do the phrases and let them sink in, because you're not trying to force it. But they doing the practice can be very powerful. And that day in particular felt like everybody just really got into it, and it transformed this prison chapel into this, you know, really amazing atmosphere where everybody was just feeling very warm and connected, is all I can say. So I really did not feel any ill will in the prison chapel that particular day. So it's a really strong counterbalance to ill will. And the last thing I'll say is that I use ill will as kind of a, what's the word? Well, when I notice the ill will is arising, like I'm thinking thoughts of ill will towards somebody else, then that's when I really try to stop and be like, wait a minute, things are really getting off the rails here, because my intention is not to be sending people ill will. So that's when I slow down and try to like turn it around. It's like things have gotten out of hand here. It's like a bellwether. So Kevin in his book talks about how one definition of metta is non-ill will, because sometimes it's hard for us to you know, send certain people actual thoughts of, you know, true loving kindness, but we can pretty much send everybody, you know, just have non-ill will towards them. I don't wish them harm, even if they drive me nuts. I wouldn't want them to be harmed. And that can be a really nice starting place. Just non-ill will. Practicing non-ill will. So, I will end there. May you cultivate non-addiction and non-ill will. Thank you for listening. And I'll open it up now for any questions people might have.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.